From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Presidential hopeful Barack Obama made his way through a whirlwind tour this week, taking him inside the war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq, to the mountains of Jordan, and through the streets of Berlin, where more than 200,000 adoring fans waited to see him. And throughout this tour, the media followed.
Well, just hours after Barack Obama landed in Baghdad, the Iraqi government
that he visited here in Iraq was
into a gym full of troops in Kuwait.
And they followed.
There you see it. Barack Obama's touching down in Jordan
on a mountaintop against the backdrop of
followed.
We're here, of course, in advance of Barack Obama's start.
I met with Barack Obama here in Amman.
We talked about all of that with the senator today.
The Obama coverage frenzy led to outrage within the McCain campaign, which, to illustrate its anger, issued mock press passes to those unfortunate reporters still stateside covering McCain. The passes read, JV squad left behind to report in America. In fact, the McCain campaign thought the media's attention on Obama crossed over the line into love.
The media's love affair with Barack Obama is all-consuming.
I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
That's from a video on McCain's website asking supporters to vote for the song that best characterizes the love between Obama and the media. Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, says that since June, when Obama emerged as the presumptive nominee, 78% of election-related articles mention Obama, while only 51% mention McCain. Rosensteel says this doesn't necessarily mean the media are in the tank for Obama, but he's not surprised McCain is making that argument.
It's a time-honored tactic that often doesn't work. Let's not forget that the first President Bush, near the end of his campaign, when the polls were not moving, began to criticize the press and even had bumper stickers that said, "Annoy the media, re-elect Bush." That was a last gasp for George Bush, and I think whether it works or not depends on when it comes in a campaign.
Well, this is pretty early. I mean, we're not even at the conventions yet, and he's already pulling out this trick, which is often, as you suggest, the last refuge of a desperate candidate. Why do you suppose he's already going down this road?
Well, if you start attacking the press early in a campaign, you're working the refs. You're trying to get the press to change its behavior. The press is highly sensitive to criticism and will quickly evaluate whether these charges are perceived to have merit. And if they are, history suggests it may cause the press to change its behavior. We only have to remember back to February when Hillary Clinton accused the press of being soft on Obama. I think there's little doubt, and our data certainly support the idea that after she did that, the press became more skeptical of Obama.
Well, it's certainly true that Obama has gotten the preponderance of coverage. Preponderance of coverage is not the same thing as bias, is it?
No, it's not. If John McCain were ahead in the polls, laying low in the press wouldn't be a problem. Press attention doesn't equal winning. Press attention is a kind of oxygen. It's necessary for winning, but it's not sufficient. And some of the storylines here are not all positive for Obama. In our data, we see, is Obama a flip-flopper and a hypocrite is becoming a kind of a staple of the narrative. And the second thing is that there are a host of journalistic reasons why he may be getting more coverage. He is new. He is historic. The crowds are large. All of those things make him a better story. But there was also a question of whether the press, in following those journalistic instincts, has created an unlevel playing field for McCain. And that's something that journalists have to worry about. Then you can throw in, is the press also in the tank for Obama? Is there bias here? That's an unanswerable question, I think, that will never be resolved.
If, as you suggest, that this whole campaign is a way early in the race to play the refs, to get them to be less likely to call a foul, how should the press react? Should they look inward to see if they're being too tough on McCain, or to say, should they just trust their instincts, even if it means a caravan to Europe to follow Obama?
press has extra responsibilities in a campaign. Normally you don't worry about, oh, gee, we're covering the mayor too much. We should tack back and cover the governor more. But campaigns are different because the press is both covering the news and sort of conducting the job interview on behalf of the public. And if they create a situation where they have made it manifestly harder for one candidate to get elected, that's a problem, I think. Even if all the reasons that they're covering one candidate more are defensible. And so I think that the press may tack back here.
Okay, a point taken. But doesn't it also behoove the McCain campaign to do or say something fundamentally newsworthy?
Yes, I think that's part of McCain's problem, that he's not generating much interest. But intellectual consistency is not one of the hallmarks typically of candidates. And, you know, McCain can have an empty message and also complain about the press not covering him. And there's a risk for McCain here, too, in doing this, which is if you want to work the refs, but you don't want to look like a whiner, that's unappealing to voters. And ultimately, it's voters who decide these things and not, obviously, the media. So now that McCain has made his statement, it's probably wise to leave it to surrogates from here on to complain about the press. Or you look like somebody who's got four fouls and can't seem to play defense cleanly and, you know, is on the brink of being ejected.
Okay, Tom. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tom Rosenstiel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. This week saw a great judicial victory for the unalienable right of celebrity breasts to be accidentally momentarily exposed. That is, of course, what happened to Janet Jackson in the infamous 2004 Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction that resulted in a $550,000 FCC fine against CBS. But this week, a federal appeals court threw out the fine. The second time in a year, a court has invalidated an FCC indecency sanction. In 2007, a different federal panel ruled that the FCC could not fine Fox for so-called fleeting expletives uttered by Cher and Nicole Richie at the Billboard Music Awards. Adam Thier, a senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, who wrote an amicus brief arguing against the FCC, says the fine was overturned because the FCC has consistently been more lenient in the past.
What the court meant by that is that basically for the last 30 years, the FCC has not engaged in serious fines or regulation for fleeting words or images that may have appeared on radio or television. So, for example, an extended Howard Stern monologue would be fine, but maybe a brief slip of the tongue by a newscaster would not. And here the FCC seemed to be changing policy in a fairly significant way. The court said you can't do that without having some more substantive justification for that and clearly announcing it to the world before you start dishing out fines to broadcasters.
I want to briefly go back to 2004 and the alleged wardrobe malfunction, which created an awful lot of controversy over whether Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake had actually rigged the thing to happen intentionally. You know, putting aside whether it was truly an accidental 9/16th of a second exposure, what was the FCC's rationale for issuing a fine for such a tiny sliver of time?
Well, the FCC ruled that this very small exposure of skin essentially was a gross violation of public morals and indecency standards that had been on the books for some time. Now, of course, these rules and standards are anything but clear. It's always an eye of the beholder problem. But in this decision most recently from the court this week, they basically punted on that issue. It's impossible to label this a great First Amendment victory because what the court has done is told the FCC, you've messed up on procedural grounds. But the court has nothing to say in this ruling about whether or not this really was unjustifiable or really indecent. But of course, this all could end up at the Supreme Court. Now, will they rule strictly on procedural issues about how the FCC enforced the rule? Or will they get into those substantive issues raised by the old Pacifica case involving the late George Carlin, the seven dirty words and the whole indecency regime? That's a question none of us really have an answer to right now. And so we have to wait and see what happens when it gets kicked to that level.
Pending a Supreme Court decision, is it possible that the FCC will react by saying, okay, you considered this a capricious and anomalous fine. Okay, we will now start finding many other breaches for even more insubstantial infractions, and we'll cover that procedural question quite neatly.
It very well could be the case that the FCC responds to this by going out and trying to find other types of programming in significant numbers. But they've been put on warning now by the courts about how far they can go here. But moreover, there's just the general backlash that's coming, I think, from a lot of different quarters now about the sensibility of this regulatory regime going forward and the increasing unfairness of it all for traditional broadcast radio and television operators. I mean, what really kills me about this debate, and it was not mentioned in the court case at all, but I think is important, is that this whole regime is premised on the idea of, quote unquote, protecting the children from potentially objectionable fare. Well, whatever sense that rationality for regulation might have had, say, 3 or 4 decades ago, one wonders how much sense it makes in an age when the kids are turning away in fairly large numbers from traditional broadcast platforms and towards new media platforms like the internet, social networking, DVDs, cable and satellite, all of which are unregulated.
And of course, at any given moment, just one click away from porn.
And that's correct. And so when the FCC fines broadcast radio and television operators in the name of protecting children, and the children have bolted to different media platforms, one wonders, is the FCC really protecting children, or is it simply protecting adults from their own choices?
Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Thier is a senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation in Washington. Coming up, posting comments may come with a feel-good factor, but is it good for the media? This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And now for a few of your letters and comments. Following our interview with Muslim graduate student Nassim Mithuwani, we got a big response, including the following. Mark from Albany, New York wrote, "How loyal is Mr. Garfield to Likud, AIPAC, the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage, and the neoconservative movement? Who purchased Mr. Garfield's new luxury car? Questions that Mr. Garfield and WNYC need to answer." Okay, here's an answer. Are you insane? About our recent interview with Zev Chaffetz on Rush Limbaugh, Julie Baxter from Austin, Texas writes, "NPR has been in the tank for Bush and his never-ending war from the get-go." Snoop Diggity Dang Dog from Virginia responds to Julie Baxter with the following, "NPR in the tank for Bush? I listen to NPR daily and it consists almost entirely of why America sucks and we should all be ashamed of ourselves stories." Interestingly, both reductionist commenters are right. Every minute of every NPR show, including OTM, is dedicated to supporting the political establishment, especially the Bush administration, and, as Mr. Diggity Dang Dog has brilliantly deduced, spitting in the face of America. And why? Because, as one shrewd observer commented just this week, the Jews tell us to. All of which is to say, while it is frequently enlightening to read the incoming here at OTM, it is also sometimes frustrating, maddening, and extremely discouraging. In our case, the frustration mainly stems from listeners who haven't seemed to actually listen before fulminating and hitting send. Other news organizations are awash in mean, hateful, and occasionally libelous rhetoric that makes us wonder how the free exchange of those particular ideas contributes to the alleged democratized online ideal. Nor are we alone in these ruminations. Recently, there's been a bit of a backlash against the angry commenter, especially the anonymous angry commenter. Newspapers around the country have had to disband comment sections because of racist content, ad hominem attacks, and vulgarity. The mayor of Hartford, Connecticut, Eddie Perez, actually staged a protest outside of the offices of the Hartford Courant in response to what he called hate speech on the paper's site. Even a reporter for Gawker, the snarky online gossip site that itself trades in mean jabs at anybody with a semblance of name recognition, urged newspapers to stop hosting the fray. Which, of course, if you believe in digital democracy and in the transfer of power from the few to the many, is absolute heresy. But, as the architects of the Iraq War can tell you, democracy is a swell idea, but not that easily achieved on the ground. Here's our friend Ira Glass of Public Radio's This American Life. Ira himself was impaled on the horns of a dilemma when comment traffic on his website got uglier and uglier.
And this culminated in this story that the woman named Deborah Gwartney did, which was just an incredibly bare piece of journalism where she tried to document why her teenage daughters ran away from home, ran away from her, okay? And, you know, they're doing drugs, they're on the road. I mean, it's just like it's very, very serious story. And it's an honest story. It's an actual honest story where somebody tries to say, here's how it happened. And so we had this story. We thought it was really just an amazing piece of work and a very brave piece of work on their part to make themselves so exposed. And at the time, we had this bulletin board on our website where people would comment on the shows, and people were just so vicious about her as a mom and about the girls, and they called the girls names. They called them sluts. And we had to go on the website. Like, I went on the website, and I said, like, please, like, these are teenage girls who are reading what you're saying about them right here. They come onto the site and they see what you're saying. So please, like, act like they're in the room and you're saying something to them in this room. Know that you are talking directly to them and use the tone of voice you would if you knew that they were hearing you. And truthfully, I and the whole staff, we just thought, like, look, that's the last straw. And we took down the bulletin board because we felt like it was an act of bad faith with our interviewees. We don't need to create a forum for the audience to express their mean-hearted opinions about people who open themselves up to us and to them. There's just no reason for that. We don't have to endorse that by giving it a space.
At that point in the conversation, I asked Ira a leading question, something along the lines of how uncivilized the discourse is online, and I more or less invited him to sneer at some portion of his audience. He didn't take the bait.
I mean, honestly, I hear you say that, and I just think that's the way the royalty feels when they're not the only ones who get a voice. Do you know what I mean? Like, up until now, you're old enough, and I'm old enough, that you were very comfortable with the one-way communication. And I feel like I hear you say this, and I feel like you are anti-democratic. You are a royalist. You are upset with democracy itself. I don't find it very comforting that there's like a world of people who don't agree with my feelings about my own show, but that's okay with me. Like, I don't have to feel good about that. I feel like, you know, you make something and you put it out in the world and you want people to have feelings about it, and the feelings can include they hate you. And that seems okay, and the fact that they get to say it and it gets to stick to my name, I feel like even that seems okay.
That's This American Life host, Ira Glass, on his ambivalence about reader comments. Writer and critic Lee Siegel, not so ambivalent. Siegel was so infuriated in 2006 with the flaming he was taking on the New Republic's website and by the magazine's policy not to intervene in the fray that he began answering the ugliest criticism in the online comments section via a pseudonym. He got caught, was suspended from his job, and treated as vain and ridiculous. Since then, he's thought deeply on the subject and written a book titled Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Electronic Mob.
I was called names that I can't really repeat on your show, but at one point someone called me a pedophile, not using that language. And I thought, you know, enough is enough. I called one of my editors and I complained about it, and they said, well, you know, this is just the way it is. You can love it or leave it. And I just answered out of exasperation and on principle, and of course out of my foolish pride, when I gave them tit for tat, and the whole thing blew up and really wasn't a very bad ending. I wrote a book. The policy at the New Republic changed. Online anonymity is part of the debate now. Every cloud has a silver lining.
What was the pseudonym you used in responding to this guy?
I chose the pseudonym Sprezzatura. By the way, I did nothing to hide my style because I did not want Sprezzatura to take credit for my best lines.
That's ironic. Tell us what Sprezzatura means.
Well, it connotes a kind of deceptive simplicity. It's a term from the Italian Renaissance. It's a way to be artful while seeming natural.
Well done. How did you get outed?
Some very, very busy and industrious commenters went back and actually did a textual analysis of my own writing and compared it to what Sprezzatura was saying and Eureka.
We've talked in general terms about how people inveigh on the web, especially when they're given the opportunity for anonymity. But it's not just nasty talk that's so frustrating. I mean, you know, it's not just name-calling. My experience is it's also, intellectual dishonesty, playing fast and loose with the truth, essentially not following the rules, not playing fair in debate or discourse. Does that drive you crazy as well?
Yeah, internet boosters are always talking about how the internet shatters old hierarchies. But that's nonsense. What the internet's creating is a new kind of hierarchy where the loudest and most aggressive voices drown out or bully into silence the most patient and reflective voices. Of course, it just makes me very exasperated to see people come online and just venting an opinion. As a critic, I'm aware of the fact that criticism has very little to do with passing judgment. The fun of criticism, the thrill, the pleasure of it, is how you get to your judgment through wit, through argument, through style, through historical analysis. But these people come online and they just vent an opinion, and it's a clamor of opinions, and it becomes incoherent.
People talk about the Platonic ideal of the democratic web, but it strikes me to be more along the lines of Lord of the Flies and reverting to human nature in a very ugly way.
Exactly. It's very schoolyard. You know, the whole dynamic behind the internet is really to appeal to our impulses, to appeal to our id. The internet is really a product of commercial society. You know, you get on, you click, you use your finger, you can get what you want when you want it. You can indulge any impulse the minute you feel it. There's no inhibition. And that's really the ideal shopper. But applied to human relations, it's disastrous.
So what's the solution for all of this? If we can agree that the internet has changed the social dynamic in many, many ways and has kind of turned the power of all institutions upside down, and the idea that individuals are now free to weigh in is so attractive in so many ways, how can that power be harnessed, the power of the individual to express a viewpoint for good instead of commotion?
Well, in terms of people just venting their opinions, I really have to take a very unpopular position here and say I don't see how that can be harnessed for good. I don't know what good comes of that kind of clamor. It makes these individuals feel good. It gives them the illusion that they're being read. But any newspaper or magazine editor will tell you, with a winking aside, that nobody's reading these threads except the people who are on them. It's really, for the most part, a kind of cynical, commercial tactic that a lot of newspapers and magazines are using because they think it's going to help them survive. It's not helping them survive, in fact. And I think more and more, as journalists get laid off, as the internet begins to cripple newspapers and magazines, these powerful journalists who have lost their jobs are going to start speaking out against it as opposed to pandering to it, which they've been doing for the past 10, 15 years.
Lee, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Siegel is the author most recently of Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Electronic Mob. Carol Tarrant is editor of the Roanoke Times. She believes that the voices of her community must be heard, albeit not necessarily in a free-for-all.
It's not the Wild West. I don't believe in putting up comments with every story. We've been through this before, and it surprises me that this conversation still keeps coming up because I thought this was dead. I thought we'd had this in like 2002, and papers are getting in this conversation and acting surprised that there's this ugliness out there. It's been in part of the internet since, you know, as long as I can remember.
Well, maybe it is a function of larger news organizations with national and international readership.
Mm-hmm.
The dynamic, as you suggest, is very different for, let's just say, the Washington Post or the Guardian than it is for the Roanoke Times. I guess you don't have a whole lot of people in California writing in on your local school board.
No. You know, we reach a much larger audience with college football. You know, Virginia Tech is here. But otherwise, it's a community of people who live here or used to live here or know people here. The vast majority of journalism in this country is at markets of my size and smaller. In those markets, I've seen people see those message boards as a kind of an area of civic debate, and they will have these thoughtful conversations about what's important in the community and take our stories to another place that we couldn't have imagined. They will react to things that we might have buried in a story. It might be in the sixth paragraph, and they're going, oh, this is really interesting, and kind of propelling us to investigate maybe an angle of the story we hadn't thought of.
You had an interesting comment in your piece about the question of anonymity. Mm-hmm. Often that offers impunity for trolls and hateful jerks, but you point out that sometimes it gives individuals in the community freedom to make considered commentary that they couldn't do if they left their names. Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, I mean, if you can imagine, we had a kind of an embattled school system in Roanoke a few years ago, and there were teachers who were very much afraid for their jobs if they spoke out publicly. There was no way they could feel comfortable about writing a signed letter to our editor and have it published in our newspaper with their name. That message board gave them an opportunity to, it wasn't just a matter of, you know, slamming the superintendent. It was, this is what's going on in our schools, and you all need to know about it. And then readers who had their children in school going, I didn't know that was the case, or I thought that was the case, but you're giving me a new insight.
A few moments ago, you mentioned Virginia Tech, which is in Blacksburg, not far from Roanoke, and was the site a year and a half ago of a horrendous massacre, a young man gunning down his fellow students and some professors. You had, of course, intensive coverage of that episode. Were those stories open to comments? And how revealing and helpful were they?
Almost from the very beginning, when we got news of the shooting, we knew online that we needed to offer people some way to comment on what happened. We initially put up just our generic message board, and you know, what we expected is people commenting on the shootings and, hey, do you know where this person is? Are they okay? And kind of using it as a community bulletin board, there are a few people that tried to hijack it and talk about gun control. So we pulled down that message board and we went to something called legacy.com, which is a vendor that many newspapers use to host their obituaries. And attached to those obituaries are moderated message boards, and they are very much screened. Comments are not posted live. They're looked at by editors within legacy.com. And we personally couldn't spend the time right then to look at those comments because we were so busy trying to cover the news. Those comments came in, and they're still coming in today. If you look at any of the obituaries from any of the victims of that, it's a very live kind of tribute site to what happened. And to not have that just would have been a huge disservice to the community.
So is it democratic? Is it something less than democratic? I mean, where does it fit in the overall scheme of the digital democracy that is supposed to be the ideal?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. I mean, it's not the editorial page, which I just don't believe represents what people are saying, but it's not say anything. Yeah, we are going to kind of keep you in these loose boundaries, and we'll let a lot of stuff fly before we ban you or we take the post down. But when you've been doing it long enough, I think the community of people participating, they know what the ground rules are. And I really believe if you're a newspaper online and you don't allow this, you're not really online. You got to invest in this and really think about it and not just shut off the pipeline. We have a whole generation that's trained to expect to be able to voice their opinion, not just to read the news, but to talk about it or share it. And that may be ugly or it may be really provocative, but I want to hear it.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Carol Tarrant is the editor of the Roanoke Times. And speaking of commentary, this week the subject of my ad criticism column in Advertising Age was a commercial from the UK for Snickers candy bars. It featured a speed walker in tight shorts wiggling his butt goofily down the street. Too goofily for Mr. T, who charged after him in a pickup truck, hollering this.
Speed walking! I pity you, fool! You a disgrace to the man race! It's time to run like a real man!
You a disgrace to the man race, get some nuts. This was not only the latest in a cluster of TV ads ridiculing men deemed insufficiently masculine by the sponsor, it was Snickers' second such in 6 months. But unlike January's Super Bowl spot featuring two auto mechanics in an accidental kiss and their panicked homophobic reactions, the Mr. T ad was explicitly homophobic itself. The girly man race walker gets mowed down with a candy bar Gatling gun for the crime of looking like a sissy. A repulsive exercise, all in all, and the ad was pulled globally by Thursday. Shockingly, though, about half of the many readers who commented on the Ad Age website could see nothing wrong with the spot. "Lighten up," they said. "You're being so PC," they said. "It's only a commercial," they said. Yeah, it's only a commercial that caricatures an objectionable other, dehumanizes him, and makes him the victim of violence, like those hilarious German cartoons of Jews in the 30s. Ha ha ha. Yeah. Let's all lighten up. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Join me now, won't you, for a journey back in time. Back to a simpler summer when America was not at war, Osama bin Laden was not a household name, and the media's attention surplus disorder was focused on shark attacks and the disappearance of a young Washington intern.
Today marks 4 weeks since Chandra Levy, the young woman working as an intern in Washington, D.C., was last seen.
Yes, the story of Chandra Levy, a still unsolved murder that inspired one of the great media circuses of all time.
Meanwhile, police would like to hear more details from Representative Gary Condit. Investigators plan to interview the congressman tonight.
It's probably grossly unfair to this congressman. There's an awful lot of attention on him. At this point, we simply don't know, but the relationship does at least appear bizarre.
May I ask you, was it a sexual relationship?
Suspicion fell on Condit, who was married, Levy's boss, and more than twice her age. He didn't help his own case much. He misled the police, lied to the public, and provoked suspicion when he was caught disposing of a box that once contained a Tag Heuer watch in an out-of-the-way dumpster. Ultimately, D.C. police declared that the congressman was not a suspect. Okay, let's return to the present day. This weekend, the Washington Post wraps up a controversial 12-part series on the murder of Chandra Levy. Among the reasons it's controversial, if you didn't remember that Gary Condit was exonerated, you were left wondering about his innocence until the very last installment of the series. Jeff Lean, assistant managing editor for investigations at the Post, oversaw the series, and he joins me now. Jeff, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
Is this a new form for the Post?
A new form for the print Post. We did try a serial like this, but it ran online only. It was called Citizen K Street, about a lobbyist. But we've had some remarkable series over the years, the Cheney series, the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal, a recent 9-part series we did on farm subsidies. But I have to say that the readership for the Levy series has been another order of magnitude. You know, we're hearing from lots and lots of people who say, I'm reading every word, I can't wait for the next chapter. And that's something that ordinarily doesn't happen with even our best investigative series.
There are some new developments, particularly insofar as questions about missed investigative opportunities at the time of the crime. But much of the series is reiteration. What is the news value that drove the decision to put so many resources into this serial?
There are a lot of new revelations and new facts that we're printing about this story that nobody has read before. Also, first and foremost, this is a police accountability story and a press accountability story. It's an examination of how a police force that's had trouble historically with homicide investigations went awry on this one in some particular areas and overlooked some promising leads, lost time, had internal squabbles and made mistakes, which is, you know, it's important to all of us, the performance of our police department on the most serious crime there is, which is homicide. And also it's a story about how the luridness of the story, the fact that a congressman was involved with a young intern, created an enormous press interest in this. And the press interest, to certain extents, drove and distorted what the police were trying to do. And the press wrote many, many, many stories about this and got many of them wrong. Now you can read the facts and you can finally understand what really happened and how it happened, how pressures led to mistakes. At the end of it all, an opportunity to catch a killer was lost.
As to your assertion that this is first and foremost a series about police accountability and press accountability, I can't buy that. To me, it's first and foremost a whodunit. It's spun out in a kind of true crime format that reminds me of nothing so much as, you know, court TV. Do you think that's unfair?
People have told us it reads like a mystery novel, and I wouldn't disagree with that at all. But I wouldn't have wanted to do a story that was just that. We knew from our own information that serious mistakes had been made here, that the mistakes had not been aired, and that the investigation got very close and didn't complete. And so we wanted to go back into that and really explore that in depth. And we believe that by the end of it, you'll know everything the police know about this case.
One of the most explosive criticisms came from within your own organization. A Metro reporter, Robert Pierre, believes that the story is a fundamentally racist by virtue of focusing on the death of one young white woman 7 years ago in a city where 200-some African-Americans are murdered every year with very little investigation by the Washington Post. Now, obviously, one response to that is that none of those 200 murders a year involve a U.S. congressman. But what have you told Robert Pierre to mollify him or to change his view?
I just basically disagree with what he's saying in a very fundamental way. We've done plenty of investigations involving African-American victims. In the year 2000, I edited a four-part series involving three reporters called Fatal Flaws, and it was a look at problems with homicide investigation in the District of Columbia. We looked at 337 cases, and 99% of those were African-American victims. That was a very hard-hitting series that put in every ounce of effort and resources that we put in on Chandra Levy. We've looked at child deaths in the district in 2001. Almost all of those cases were African-American victims. We looked at the juvenile justice system in 2003, and it was the same thing. So we go where the facts lead us. And sometimes we write about characters and victims who are white, and sometimes we write about characters and victims who are African-American. So I just have to reject the criticism that what we're doing here is somehow racist.
Now, let me ask you about a very different kind of criticism, and that is a question of fairness to, of all people, Gary Condit. We're speaking on Wednesday, and at least as of today's episode, the story continues to leave open the question of Condit's culpability. If you know that a man is not guilty, is there not a sense of basic fairness that compels you to disclose that or rather than leave the question open for 12 days?
I think careful readers knew by the middle of the series that Gary Condit wasn't the guy. We decided to tell this story in a particular way. You got to lay out the evidence. You got to lay out the step-by-step process. Gary Condon has waited 7 years for somebody to go back in this and really explore his role and find out he's been unfairly thought of in this case for all this time. And we've done that.
I'm just curious whether you've heard from Condit, his lawyer, or anyone in his camp to say, what's the deal? When are you letting me off the hook for this thing? Do I have to go through this nightmare again 7 years after the fact?
We've heard from them, but they haven't raised that point. You know, like I said, I think that it's a more credible story to lay out the evidence and let the reader come to that decision than try to browbeat them with, trust us, this is what we found, believe it, because, you know, we're basing it on documents or interviews.
Considering what the Post and many other major newspapers are going through right now, retaining audience and trying to stay profitable, I fear that this is a kind of pandering to our basest morbid curiosity as opposed to your assertion that it's about demanding accountability from official sources and from the media itself. Are you confident that this is not a step onto a slippery slope of yellower and yellower journalism?
This was an attempt to see if we can use a new form of storytelling to engage readers. You know, newspapers everywhere need to engage readers. If we continue to do things the way we've always done them, then the business will die in place. We have to innovate. We have to reach readers, and we have to engage with them. And if that means experimenting with new forms, trying things different occasionally, then I think we have to do that. I mean, I don't think we have a choice to keep doing the same thing the same way we've always done it.
Okay, Jeff. Thank you so much for coming on.
Sure thing.
Jeff Lean, Assistant Managing Editor for Investigations at The Washington Post, oversaw the paper's 12-part series on the murder of Chandra Levy. Earlier this year, the television program America's Most Wanted aired an episode featuring Julia Dahl, a reporter trying to help solve the murder of a young girl she knew formerly as a source. How Dahl ended up on the show is a bit of a twisted odyssey, and what she learned from the experience is the subject of her article in the current issue of Columbia Journalism Review. Dahl started her career at women's magazines like Red Book and Marie Claire, writing stories about body image, beauty queens, and dating. A far cry from how, as a student at Yale, she imagined her journalistic career would go. And so she quit because, as she put it herself, quote, "Every time I put together an article, it felt like I was building a little lie."
I decided that I wanted to at least try to write a little more seriously, but to tell you the truth, I didn't exactly know how. I never had real, quote-unquote, journalism training. So I left the staff job and thought, all right, I'm going to go freelance. I'm going to see what I can do this way. And one of the first assignments I got freelance was from 17 magazine to write about a young woman who had murdered her mother.
Now, you were living in Georgia at this point, and clearly that subject matter is far more somber and serious than the fluff that you had been doing in New York, but it's also a staple of women's magazines, kind of the true crime genre.
Well, I really enjoyed, at least at the beginning, the first couple I did, I really enjoyed the reporting. It felt like what a real journalist would do. I was going to talk to families. I spent a lot of time with cops and with lawyers and reading trial transcripts. It felt like I was actually learning something about a serious circumstance. The problem was that the article that I had to turn in had a very rigid formula that I had to adhere to. It was 1,500 words. It began with a simple introduction, and then it had four sections, and each section had to be exactly the same for each article I wrote. Early childhood of the person I'm writing about, the lead up to the murder, and then the aftermath. And there was just no room for any of the nuance that I picked up when I was reporting. And again, it just started to feel a little bit false to me.
Even the simple, significant details from the environment that you noticed that your writerly instincts wanted you to include were deemed superfluous by your editors.
Exactly. I remember very well sitting with a grandmother of a young girl who had killed her mother, and she lived in a small trailer in Western Virginia. Her home was choked with cigarette smoke. Photos of both her daughter and her granddaughter were everywhere. It almost felt like a coffin that she was living in. And it was so dramatic to me, but it had absolutely no place in the story I was going to write. I knew that the hours I spent with her would essentially be distilled to two quotes.
Now, as a consequence of working on this piece, you ran into somebody else, and this would change your narrative substantially. Tell me about Taisha.
I was in Western Virginia reporting this story for 17 when I got a call from my editor. Katrina had just hit, and she knew that I was living down south and that a lot of the Katrina refugees were being bused to Georgia. And she said, "We want to profile a teenage girl who survived Katrina." I sort of forgot about her request until I got home a few days later, and went to volunteer at a church nearby where a couple hundred refugees were getting tetanus shots. That's when I saw Taisha. She was exactly what I was looking for. She was a teenage girl. She was stunningly beautiful. And I approached her and I said, hey, I'm a writer for 17 Magazine. Would you be willing to tell me your story?
And she said yes.
She did, actually. She had a two-year-old daughter. They'd had their home destroyed. They'd had to swim through the storm to safety. They broke into a house and were rescued a couple days later by a helicopter off a roof. So I wrote a story called I Survived Hurricane Katrina. It was in the as-told-to style that Women's and Teen Magazine use a lot, where the writer interviews someone and writes the piece in first person as if Taisha herself were actually writing the piece. And it ended with her being flown to safety. But that's not how her story actually ended.
How did her story actually end?
Well, her mother, who had her daughter, Denisha, was in Texas. And so Taisha decided that she should go to Texas. I took her to the bus station in Atlanta. And about 4 months later, I got a call from her sister, Kiana, telling me that Taisha was dead. She'd been murdered, shot in the back of the head, and left in a ditch in Fort Bend County, Texas.
Then a month and a half later, you got a phone call from America's Most Wanted, the syndicated television program, that wanted to tell the story of Taisha's murder. And they wanted you to join the project. Tell me what it was specifically that they had in mind for their narrative.
Well, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that they wanted me to be somebody I wasn't. To them, what was exciting about the story wasn't just that a young woman had been brutally murdered and her killer had not been found, but that a New York City magazine writer was involved in her death. And as we were doing an interview, they started feeding me lines like, so as you were living in New York working at women's magazines, it was a little like you were Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City, right? And when they finally asked me if I would not just do one interview, but actually travel with America's Most Wanted to Texas to meet with Taisha's family and meet with the officers working on her case, the point for them was that essentially Carrie Bradshaw had gotten caught up in the murder of a Katrina victim.
So here you were, having made some progress in your aspiration to be a serious journalist, and the circumstances of the universe converged just so that you're in the middle of a very troubling story. And lo and behold, here comes a TV show that imposes on you the very kind of silly artificial construct that you had left New York to escape. But I must say, I've seen the tape of your interviews on the show. It looked like you were, you know, in with both feet on this concept. I mean, you were not a reluctant participant, were you?
I wasn't. Even though I was uncomfortable with how I realized they were going to betray me, I decided that that wasn't important, that what was important was that nobody seemed interested in a young girl who'd survived Katrina, been torn from her family structure, tried to start a new life, and then met this brutal end. Nobody seemed to care about that. But what they cared about was that I, or some version of me, was involved in this. And so I decided that Taisha definitely deserves to have someone locked up for murdering her. But she deserves to have her story told. And if this is the only way that her story can be told, that I'm okay with that. I decided that it was my moral duty, if you will, to stand in front of the camera and be what they wanted me to be so that the story was interesting enough that they would put it on television.
So tell me, Carrie Bradshaw, was it like the Sex and City movie, something that had a happy ending?
No. Nobody's been locked up or arrested for killing Taisha. I spoke a few months ago, right after the show aired, with the detective on the case, and he, even after America's Most Wanted aired, said he still had no promising leads. So far, my appearance on America's Most Wanted has not brought anyone to justice.
All right, Julia. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Julia Dahl wrote The Lives of Others in the current issue of Columbia Journalism Review. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Nadia Zonis, and edited by committee. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Gina Gasper. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.